high end over end variety. And Amati from his 45, he's got a lane. And he's got speed. Look out. Beep, beep. The Ducks are in the end zone. Touchdown.
This is the Duck Pod from the Register Guard Newsroom.
Gordon head to head for sure. Mitchell goes in motion. They hand it off straight up.
Oregon sports beat writers Ryan Thorburn and Steve Mims.
All right, we're back. Steve Mims and Ryan Thorburn. Another episode of the Duck Pod. Steve, you were gone last week. I had Kelly Graves in here. Where's
it won't
Dana?
Be as entertaining today.
Where's Dana Altman at? Get him in here.
He's still waiting to do his first pod at the RG Studios, but that's an indeterminate date at this point.
All right, that's an open invitation, Dana. So
absolutely.
I'm sure he's a devout listener to all media podcasts. Anyway, it's March, and we're getting ready for March Madness, Steve. You have two more home games in the regular season. The women wrapped up the regular season with a sweep of the Washington schools. Quite an event with Senior Day, considering who the seniors are. Sabrina, Ruthie, Satu leaving a year early, and obviously Mignon Moore, the graduate transfer. Where do you want to start? Let's start with the men, because they're still in a conference race here. What are the scenarios this weekend for them to join the women as conference champions?
Well, at this point, if they win out, they've got it. They're a half game back of UCLA, which is 12-5, Oregon 11-5. If they beat Cal and Stanford at home, two teams that actually are coming off a weekend sweep of Colorado and Utah. If they beat them both, the worst they can do is be tied with UCLA for the title. If they lose one of them, they need UCLA to lose to USC at USC. And if they get swept, they got no chance. So the thing I wrote about today is that the one thing Oregon's never done is what the women were able to do this week, which is cut down the nets at Matthew Knight Arena and celebrate a Pac-12 championship in front of their home fans. They've only won three men's basketball conference titles in the history of the program, and all three were done on the road. So we'll find out. We'll know more after Thursday. They play Thursday, so at that point, they'll either be tied for first or one back, and then you'll know going into UCLA plays early Saturday, Oregon late, so all the scenarios will be known by the time Oregon tips it off against Stanford at 8 o'clock Saturday.
Yeah, college basketball is obviously a home court sport, but it's pretty amazing the women went unbeaten at home, mm-hmm. including an exhibition win over the U.S. women's national team. And right now the men are 15-0 at home, I believe. That's pretty rare for both units to go undefeated at home, and obviously the football team was undefeated at Autzen, and it's been quite a run for Oregon Athletic Department in Eugene.
Yeah, if you don't watch games on the road and just show up for games, you think these teams are winning national titles, which quite frankly, two of them might be in the mix in basketball, and the football team was up there too. So yeah, it's Oregon went undefeated a couple years ago under Dane Altman at home during one of those Dylan Brooks years, and they ended up having like the nation's longest home winning streak at one point at like 42 in a row after the Final Four year, and then kid from Boise State hit a three-quarters court shot that knocked it off. But Oregon's always been good at home, and you know, that's why this schedule works out well for them. They come here, USC. He's got to go on the road. Arizona State, which is behind them and still technically in the only other team technically in the race with six losses, they're at home this week too against Washington State. So you figure they end at six. So if Oregon loses one of the games this week, they probably will end up in either a three-way tie for first or a two-way tie with ASU for second. And the tiebreakers are crazy because they're all out there. But the fact that if UCLA wins it, Oregon's got the one win over them would give them a nice advantage in any tiebreakers.
The Bruins are quite a story. Obviously, Mick Cronin had a lot of success at Cincinnati. He's very hard-nosed defensive coach. Maybe not a cultural fit from what UCLA traditionally has done, but after a rough start, it's certainly working. They've won seven in a row. What do you make of the Bruins going into the stretch here?
Yeah, it's weird. There was Bob Clark, who used to work here, writes for AP now. When Oregon beat them like 96-75 a couple years ago, he looked on Press Row and said, that might be the worst Bruins team I've ever seen. And it was weird because they brought back like everybody who could come back. I mean, they had a couple guys who went pro, but he basically brought back a bunch of guys and then they lost, you know, like I say, just the main guys. But, you know, they were 1-3 at the start. I think they were 7-6 in non-conference, and it's been amazing to watch. I think they've won seven in a row, 8 out of 9. They've had like three weekend sweeps in a row. crazy thing about it is Chris Smith's the only guy on the team averaging more than 9 points a game. I mean, it's just sort of this, like you say, defensive unit put together, and they're coming through with some big plays offensively when they need to. And you know, it's another situation where they may win the regular season title and still need to get a win or two in Vegas to get into the NCAA tournament just because how bad they were non-coming. Lost, what, Hofstra in the non-conference play. So they, even if they win this thing, it could be like, you know, 2012 or 13 it was when Washington won the conference and didn't get in, you know, because they didn't win the tournament title. I think UCLA could be in a situation where they could go to Vegas still needing a win, even if they're the number one seed.
Yeah, I think they've won 9 of 10 since getting drubbed by Oregon. Obviously, Colorado, last time we talked, was in a great position in first place. And then they go on the road and lose to the Bay Area schools, as you mentioned. And those two programs aren't very good this year. And then Arizona State's up there now. How do you kind of see the Pac-12 in terms of at-large bids? How many do you think they're going to get for the NCAA tournament?
You know, it seems, I think Colorado's in with Oregon. I think Arizona State's in. I think Arizona's in. I think those four are in for sure. I think UCLA's still on the bubble. I think that Stanford is – I think Stanford's off of it right now. I don't think they're in there. I think USC. I think Stanford, USC, and UCLA may all need at least one win in the Pac-12 tournament. But I think the Devils, the Buffs, because I think Arizona State's going to win two games this week, so I think that gets them in. Colorado should be in there, even if they somehow collapse at Utah and lose four straight in the regular season. Big thing for them right now is that, you know, I think Oregon, ASU, and UCLA look like a pretty good lock to get the three first-round byes. Kind of looks like it'll come down to the rest of those, and if Colorado can beat Utah, they're in a pretty good spot there. Otherwise, Arizona probably gets it. So I think the conference will get five. I just think there's four that are locked in now. I think one of those other three for sure gets in, maybe two to get them to six.
Oregon obviously opened this homestand with a victory over Oregon State in the Civil War, 96-75, after losing in Corvallis earlier this season. What do you make of Wayne Tinkle at this point? He's been there a while now. He's had gone through all of the assistant's sons and his own son that he can go through, never really gained much traction. What do you think the vibe is with that program going forward?
Yeah, it's weird. You know, last year they get the, you know, they finally get the top four seed in the first round bye, and, you know, they've swept Oregon. It looked like, boy, they've kind of got a little momentum, and then they lose in the first round of the Pac-12 tournament to Colorado, and Oregon goes on and wins it, and it's like same old, same old. And this year you came in, and, you know, this was sort of the year, especially, you know, they win at Colorado, they win down in the Bay Area, what, at Stanford. I mean, they got some good road wins, and you think, boy, if you just kind of take, you know, Trace Tinkle leading this veteran group, you get a couple nice wins and then take all the gimmies on the schedule, you know, they should have been, you know, 10-8, 11-7. Well, they lost most of those gimmies on the schedule. They lost to Arizona State at home, at Utah, something like that. So I think the bigger problem for Oregon State right now is, you know, this season's become, you know, has gone off the rails a little bit. They're, you know, this looks like a team that may win that first round tournament game, but they're gonna have a hard time getting beyond that. And next year, what's this team look like? I mean, they lose Kelly, they lose Tinkle. You know, you're coming back next year with like a foundation of what, Ethan Thompson and Zach Reichel, and not a great recruiting class coming in. So I think the bigger concern if you're Oregon State right now is, you know, this year obviously is a disappointment for you, but next year maybe even worse than that.
Back to the Ducks, and you wrote about this on DuckSports.com, but, you know, Dante was hurt, and now Duarte is hurt. When are the Ducks ever going to get both of the D's, D's out there?
There's been three games all year when they've had their entire roster available. My guess on Duarte is you hold him out this week. You know, I think he'd be ready this week. And if there's a question going to the Pac-12 tournament, you hold him out just knowing that he's going to be so important in sort of an NCAA run. So I would think that we don't see him back until the first round of the NCAA tournament, possibly in Vegas. But again, I just think, you know, a pinky on your shooting hand is broken. That doesn't feel to me like something he's going to play in 2 weeks. I think you try to rest it out for 3 weeks, get through it that way. Dante, try to work him up to, I mean, I don't think at this point he can give him more than about 15 minutes a game. He was pretty winded the other day. I think you just hope you can get 15 minutes from him, get Duarte back for the tournament. And, you know, if you can get in there as a 3 or 4 seed, maybe you get that first round game to, you know, against a 13 seed to ease your way in, and then go from there. But I think at this point the NCAA is probably the next chance for them to be at full strength.
So that's the story on the men's side. The women obviously had a eventful week, which started last Monday with Sabrina speaking at the Kobe Bryant Memorial and then flying back for a big win at Stanford that pretty much wrapped up their third consecutive Pac-12 title. Friday they beat Washington State, and that's the day they officially clinched it outright. And then, as we mentioned, Sunday they beat Washington on Senior Day. This team has won 16 consecutive games going into the Pac-12 tournament this week. They have, you know, a ton of wins over ranked teams, including road wins over ranked teams that really nobody in the country can match up with their resume. So I think they're a lock, obviously, to host the first and second round, and then they'll be the top seed at the Portland Regional. Life is good for Kelly Graves.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, we were talking on this 2 weeks ago, and I was saying, well, I just think that the problem is, boy, are they peaking too early, because you still got, you know, a month plus to go. Well, the next 2 weeks, they go down and beat Stanford on the road and then come home and destroy Washington State. So, I mean, this doesn't feel at this point like it's a peak. I mean, this has been a month and a half. This starts to feel like this is who they are. And now if you say, man, can they keep doing this for another month? Well, I mean, why not? I mean, at this point, we've seen it for 6 weeks in a row. We've seen, you know, this group has beaten good teams. It's not like a, you know, a Baylor or something who's in a bad conference and is just putting up big numbers. They've beaten top 10 teams all over, but they've swept Stanford, they swept Oregon State, swept Arizona. You look at, I mean, the road through the Pac-12 tournament, if they beat Arizona and Stanford, that's, you know, basically what, two top 10, top 15 teams that they'll have three wins over. So I don't know what the, you know, South Carolina and Baylor are doing. I know that they keep staying ahead of them in all these projections, but I don't know if Oregon's got enough runway left to put up, you know, they should get a couple more top 25 wins here this week. But again, we talked about before, if you get that one seed, it seems like that's a lot different than the two and three, but it just feels like Oregon's kind of stuck for whatever reason behind Baylor and South Carolina in those right now.
Yeah, I asked Kelly about it on the podcast last week, and he made the case, you know, with all the quality wins and the just the winning streak they're on, that they should, you know, be the number one overall seed, assuming they win the Pac-12 mm-hmm. tournament. He thinks that would be the one to push them over the edge, obviously. I think when you look at South Carolina, they went 16-0 in the SEC, which is a pretty good league, where Oregon did have the blemish at Arizona State. Now, granted, Arizona State is at the bottom of the top 25, but still they have that blemish where South Carolina doesn't have one of those. And then, obviously, Baylor's only loss is to South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I've been voting South Carolina 1, Oregon 2, Baylor 3. Most of the people have Oregon 3. I really think there's a great argument for them to be 1. And, you know, we'll see who they play in Vegas. I'll be heading that way later this week. But, you know, I think they've already proven that they're so superior to Stanford.
Yeah.
I think it would be more entertaining, actually, if the Oregon State Beavers make a run and there's a Civil War Part 3 down in Vegas.
Yeah, because what, the second round Oregon would get Arizona, which, you know, gave them a close game down there, and then Oregon came out here and handed it to them here. You're right. I mean, I think, you know, we were talking both those first two Stanford matchups. You know, the first one looked like this major event, and last time it was, boy, can Stanford at home kind of get him, but now we've seen him just destroy him both times. So you figure if Oregon goes in there with what, you know, what, playing the way they're playing right now, that tournament, I mean, despite the fact that you're going to have four or five top 25 teams littered, it's just there's nobody since that ASU game that's given any indication that they can hang with Oregon in a tournament scenario.
The other difference for Oregon is, last year, they basically had a rotation that was about six or seven deep. They didn't have much of a bench. It was all relying on the starters. And then heading into the postseason, Taylor Chavez was out with a foot fracture, so they didn't have her at all in Vegas or through the NCAA tournament. Totally different scenario now. Everybody's healthy, including Taylor. They have Jazz Shelley off the bench now, freshman guard. You know, Lydia Giomi's healthy. She's a backup big when Ruthie needs a rest. So not only are they have they won 16 games in a row, they're completely healthy, which was not the case last year, and they're fresh because of that depth. And then they obviously get a week off in between Vegas and the NCAA tournament. So really, you know, barring an injury in Vegas, they're even better positioned from a health standpoint than last year.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes a loss in Vegas isn't the worry. You know, if they were to go there and drop that second one or something like that, you know, sometimes that's, if you're planning for a deep NCAA run, sometimes you'd rather play two than three there. And if by chance, you know, they were really locked into the three and they, you know, if maybe Kelly's right that if they win that thing, they get the one, but maybe he's just kind of trying to get that word out there and kind of politic for his team a little bit. If by chance they are locked into not being able to get the one, if South Carolina wins it, then a loss in Vegas isn't all that bad for him. Like I say, may save him some legs from a game, still going to keep him as the three seed in there, so it wouldn't have a huge overall impact if there's no chance to get to the one, which seems to be the idea from what we're hearing from most of the projections.
So you've been around here a long time. You remember Matt Court. I wasn't here for any Matt Court You know, the women had a good following in the 90s when they had it going a little bit at Mac Court. Obviously, I don't think this community has seen anything like the rise of the Oregon women's program of late. Even going back to Sabrina's freshman year, they weren't drawing more than 4,000 or 5,000 at most games, even though they had a really good team. And it's just gradually built up to now where, you know, almost every game is the sellout 12, 3, 6, 4, whatever it is. Have you ever seen anything like that from women's sports around here before?
No, and the crazy part of that, the one that got me was the Friday night one sold out. It was against Washington State, which is the worst team in the conference. Right. It's an 8 o'clock game. It's on TV. It's not the senior day game. That's sort of the one. I mean, if that's, you know, most others, that's not selling. Not many people are buying tickets for that because they're just looking at the Sunday one or the games against Stanford and the good teams. But the fact you're now selling out the worst place team coming here at a terrible 8 o'clock on a Friday night in a game that doesn't mean anything, you know it's going to be. My sister was in town and went to the game, and I said, you know, watch, you know, enjoy the first couple minutes, and it turns out it was 13-0 and it was over from there, and you knew that if you bought tickets. And she said everybody was at the Wild Duck by halftime and stayed there for the second half. But, you know, the fact that people are buying tickets for that game, that really you knew the outcome and there was no real special thing going on around it just because people are trying to get tickets, to me kind of capsulize what kind of the what marketplace that program's taken in this town.
Well, it ended up where they, you know, Sabrina and the program decided to have a personalized video tribute about their, like a kind of a behind the scenes video after the game of what all they went through in Corvallis the day Kobe died, and, you know, how they supported each other and got that win and were there for Sabrina, which was a really cool thing that they put together. And then they were cutting down the nets late into the night. So those who stuck around did have some interesting memories from that game. I wrote last week in five takeaways, you know, about Sabrina. I think you put her on a Mount Rushmore of all-time Oregon Ducks with, you know, maybe Eaton, Prefontaine, Mariota, whoever else you want to put on there. I think she's the female voice on that Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, she is. And, you know, I mean, it's all kind of happened so fluidly, you know. But someday when you look back and say, you know, if they win this title, and she came back and said, and oh, by the way, in the middle of it, an hour before she was set to play a game, this hero and idol of hers died, and then 5 hours before she has to play in basically the Pac-12 championship game, she has to give a speech at the funeral for this person. It's like, I mean, it's things like I say, as they happen, it's just sort of now you're just kind of like, oh yeah, she's doing that, this and that. But at some point when people take a step back and look at what she did this year, if, you know, and you, you know, coming back and saying unfinished business, and she's been saying that through the year, I mean, you got to kind of finish it off now by winning this thing. But if she comes back and wins the national title this year, a first one for Oregon, and people go back and dissect just kind of what she had to go through, the triple double, you know, which again people just kind of overlook now, but the fact that she's putting that record out of reach as well, there would be a case in there for just sort of the greatest collegiate season that anybody's had at any level of any sport. I think if she finished it off, she's going to be the national player again of the year, obviously, probably get it unanimously. The numbers are, like I say, just we kind of get used to it because it's just, you know, another triple double. She's going and talking to Kobe's, but I think at some point, if you look back at what all was entailed in that season from start to finish, if they end up cutting down the nets at the end, she's got a case for what could be just the greatest college season of any athlete in any sport.
Yeah, first of all, I don't think any man will ever break her triple double record or the quadruple triple or whatever you want to call that thing, the 2,000 points, 1,000 assists, 1,000 rebounds. No man is going to ever break that, because if you were that great a player, you're just not going to stay in college for more than one, maybe 2 years, so you're not going to have time to break it.
And but even as good a player as Peyton Pritchard, who's a four-year guy, you know, I mean, his assists are at, what, 600, and, you know, I mean, the rebounds aren't even right around there. So it's like even a really good four-year doesn't come close to that.
You would need a LeBron James to basically go to Duke for 4 years to break her records. Yeah. And, you know, there could be some, you know, second-grade girl right now that's looking up to Sabrina and, you know, does something similar, but it's hard to imagine those records ever falling. That versatile of a player who produces those numbers every night for 4 years, it's quite something. So
and even the triple doubles you mentioned, I mean, there's what, 26, and again, I'll use Peyton Pritchard's as good a point guard as you're going to find in the men's basketball game. He's got zero triple doubles. I mean, it's hard to do. It is a hard thing to do, and I know some people want to go out there and say, well, it's different. I mean, you're playing against the caliber of people you're playing against. She's playing against top 25 teams over and over again and putting them up against them too. The fact that you look and see, boy, this really good point guard, I mean, just on a night can't pop one open and the other person's doing it 26 times, is, you know, what was the record? It was 11 by Collinsworth worth? I mean,
I think it's 12 to more than
double that. And, you know, it's just, like I say, at some point people will look back and look at records and it'll be like, holy cow, how did that happen? Rather than now, it's just, you know, I mean, it gets to the third quarter of a game and you look and it's like, oh, she's got 12, 7, 8. Here comes another triple-double. I mean, it's not even like anticipation builds anymore.
Yeah, it's to the point when Steph Curry shows up at a game or LeBron James tweets about her, it's like, no big deal.
Yeah.
She's just in that peer group now. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty remarkable. Let's take a quick break, and then we will finish out with a little football because it's always football season.
Hi there. It's Les Schwab Tires. You know, we've been helping keep folks safe on the road around here since 1952. That's why you can save up to $152 on a set of four select light truck and SUV tires during our fall tire sale. So swing by or book an appointment at LesSchwab.com. Les Schwab Tires, doing the right thing since 1952. Limited time offer while supplies last. Discount depends on tire size and type. Cannot be combined with other offers. Details at LesSchwab.com.
All right, Steve, we haven't seen Mario Cristobal and company since signing day. Oregon is actually starting spring football practice on Thursday, which is the same day as the Pac-12 women's quarterfinals. So you're going to have to hold down the fort at the Hatfield Dallin Complex for a couple practices while I'm gone, but I'll be back next week. What are storylines that intrigue you this spring? Obviously, quarterback would be number one on my list.
Yeah, quarterback's be the one for everybody. I'd say a little bit of receivers, kind of looking and seeing some of the guys who are back and kind of how they shimmy up and down on the depth chart. The line, you know, I think we know Penei Sewell's going to be on the left side, but who's going to fill in the other four spots? I think that's a fascinating one. I think looking at what there's eight true freshmen who are here already, kind of getting a look at Butterfield and kind of that group of guys, and then, you know, DJ Johnson going over to the offensive side, and that's so far as we know, kind of the only major positional change, but seeing kind of where he's done with, that's a big body out there, seeing if he can catch some balls and kind of look like he's an offensive guy adjusting over there.
Yeah, and you remember last year, Levitt and Cristobal broke up essentially on Valentine's Day, and then you know, there's a search process.
They delayed spring football to get Avalos.
So you get Avalos late, and he had to cram, do a cram session, and then the players had to cram for his system. I think it all worked out pretty well considering all that. Now he's in year two, which is the year your defense is supposed to take a step forward if you're a good coordinator. So with all the talent they're adding to what's returning, I think defensively that's fascinating to me because going into next season, they're going to be one of the best defenses on paper in the country, and there'll be major question marks at quarterback on offense, and that's interesting for Oregon Ducks football.
Well, it could be interesting too that, I mean, you may see you know, everybody would look and say Thomas Graham and Diamond Lenore, you're starting cornerbacks, you know, coming back, returning. But what about Mikhail Wright? I mean, suddenly you may be looking at a situation where he beats out one of those guys. I mean, you'd be looking at safety where you got Brady Breeze and Pickett and Javon Holland. You could have a guy who, you know, just put up some pretty big accolades already who's not playing a whole lot. So that could be one interesting thing to see how that shakes out. I mean, I don't think it would happen, but, you know, do you – grad transfer possibly, you know, if some guy comes back and says, well, wait a minute, I thought I was the starter, turns out I'm not. So you're going to have a little bit of that, and obviously in the secondary you can throw out some nickels and some other ideas like that to get some more guys on the field. But you may have some pretty established guys, especially in that secondary, who may be really fighting to get on the field.
And inside linebacker, you're going to have Isaac Slade and some other veterans listed on the depth chart at the top during the spring. And Slade had a great year last year, but you got 2 5-star guys
Sewell.
Coming.
We'll get Justin to Sewell's Lowe another guy we'll get to
Noah
see here.
Sewell.
Yeah.
So a lot of competition on defense. That'll be good news for Andy Avalos.
I think offensive, spring. You know, it'll be interesting. You mentioned that, you know, Moorhead's had a little bit of time. We talked to him in the interview about him, you know, what was it, 3 weeks ago or so, and he asked about kind of what's your philosophy in terms of how much are you working with the other coordinator, with the other position coaches, with Mario, how collaborative is it? And he was talking about, you know, that's something we'll work out. I think we'd get a few more answers maybe from him, and it seems like going into spring drills about that time when you kind of have some roles determined as to who's going to be kind of helping with the play calling and this and that. So we may get a few more answers from this on Saturday, I think, when Moorhead's available for the first time after being on the field.
And obviously Mario dodged maybe a little bit of a bullet, but Alabama loses its strength and conditioning coordinator, who's famous, has his own commercials, Scott Cochran, to Georgia for an on-field coaching position. So people were obviously worried that Alabama would come after Aaron Feld, but they end up hiring someone from Indiana. So Don't worry, the handlebar mustache isn't going anywhere for now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, quite honestly, that's a position I think, you know, if Feld had left, I know that, you know, you always have people who the sky has fallen, but I think Mario's got a pretty good reputation in the strength community. That's a guy that, you know, just take a look at Mario. I think a strength coach is going to feel pretty good about, you know, being on that guy's staff. So even if that's a position I felt like they could lose somebody at, and with kind of the fourth quarter program he's got going, his reputation for how much he, you know, accounts for that strength coach, you're going to get, so you would have had a lot of interest in that position from people just because how much value Oregon puts on that position.
Yeah, I think it's important because those guys spend so much time with the players. So you have to have a guy who keeps them motivated, keeps them, you know, on track throughout the offseason when the coaches aren't around them as much. But, I mean, how many different ways are there to lift weights and exercise? I mean, there's a science to it. I get it. And he has, you know, the knowledge in that. But there's a lot of guys that know how to teach guys how to lift weights properly.
Yeah, and like I say, I think Mario's reputation, how much he values that, would have made that a pretty attractive position if somebody had gone away. So, you know, then the other new guy, Rod Chance, obviously the cornerbacks coach, would be the other guy to watch, and he'll be the guy who comes in and inherits this group with two seniors and, like I say, a five-star freshman coming in and, you know, basically a starting caliber sophomore, Mikhail Wright. So that could be interesting to see how he kind of manages that group, knowing that you got a couple veterans who came back, gave up, you know, I don't know, sure how highly they would have been drafted, but who made the point that they were going to turn down to come back, and there's going to be a whole lot of competition at that spot as well.
Yeah, I think obviously they're disappointed that Dante Williams went to USC because he's a great recruiter, has a great rapport with them, but Rod Chance was here as an analyst, and they seem to be, the returning players seem to be pretty happy about the replacement there, so they already knew him, and yeah. It should be fairly flawless, especially with such a veteran group and so much depth. Speaking of lifting weights and doing things like
where's
that,
this going?
Did you catch any of the NFL scouting combine? Obviously, there were some notable ducks there, including a headliner in Justin Herbert with the quarterback group.
Yeah, I didn't. I saw his throwing night. I was watching a little bit of it, but again, it's tough. You know, when you're not covering cornerbacks out there, it's hard to sit there. It looked like he threw it really well. I didn't see any of the linemen or the linebacker days or the Breland. I know didn't work out and stuff. So, no, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to that. I do think it'll be fascinating to see how the quarter, you know, I saw now Daniel Jeremiah has got Jordan Love solidly as the third quarterback, and he's got Herbert going to the Patriots at like 24. Which I've been saying along the opposite. I thought that these combines and that would really move Herbert up, and I'd be stunned if it didn't. But it seems like there's so many analysts out there and so many people who don't really know what they're talking about, and then some people who do, and it's just kind of names get thrown all over. I still think by the time this draft comes, I think Herbert's a top 10 pick, just because I think there are enough teams that need him. People would trade. If he slips down to 8 or 9, I think you're going to see teams. You know, I think the Raiders are at 12. I mean, you're going to see teams that suddenly are trading up to get him up there. So I think Herbert goes before Jordan Love, and I think he goes in the top 10 when this draft comes down in 6-7 weeks.
I agree. I actually think all four of them will go by the middle of the first round, because I don't even know why these draft gurus would put a Herbert like at the end of the draft, because every year teams panic and fall in love and trade up, and they're going to do the same thing with all four guys. For Herbert, you just kind of, I mean, I think that would be a great scenario for him if he did slide a little bit, we've talked about it, and play behind a veteran guy like a Ben Roethlisberger for 1 year or something like that.
Yeah, although that might not be the Patriots. Scenario. Now, the Patriots might suddenly be I mean, that's the other part. You know, we'll know more by the time the draft comes, you know, where Brady, Rivers, all these guys end up. So a lot of the guessing right now is without that. But, yeah, I'm with you. I think if he could go somewhere and have a year to, you know, learn from it before he goes out there. But, you know, for most places who are making those picks, that's not what they do. Most people don't take a top 10 quarterback to sit behind somebody for a year. It's more likely it would be I still think the Raiders are going to move up there to 8 or 9 and get him. They've got like the 12 and the 19th. I think they move up, take him, and then he's their guy from the start after they boat him in at the draft in front of the Bellagio or the fountains there and coordinate him their quarterback. I think that's where he's going, and I think he's their opening day starter.
Yeah, that's the way it's trended the last 4 or 5 years. If you're drafted in the first round, you're going to play. They're not waiting. And an incredible percentage of guys have worked out. It's different now. I think it's because the NFL is embracing their systems from college, and let's run what they're used to running and tweak it a little bit. We're not going to, you know, force them to run a pro-style NFL offense if that's not what they do. Mm-hmm. You know, Herbert mentioned in his presser that, you know, he's been working under center and this and that, but I don't think that matters. I think if the Raiders like him, they'll tailor the offense about around what he does well.
Yeah, and I think Gruden's like that. I think Gruden wanted him last year, and I think Gruden's been waiting out. I think Gruden's sitting there at 12-11, these projections. It happened to 23. I would almost guarantee if he gets to 12, if that's where the Raiders are, if I'm right on that, that he doesn't get past that. But I even think of it, like I say, because they have two from that Khalil Mack deal. I think they could move up a few spots, and that's why I say I don't see there's any reason he drops out of the top 10.
Yeah, Burrow is still projected number one. He's an Ohio guy, to Cincinnati. I think that's great for the other three because they don't have to go to Cincinnati. Yeah. The real key will be, will Detroit or Washington panic on their current situations? Yeah, they have Stafford. The Redskins took
Haskins last year.
Will they say, you know what, Tua is better than our guy, let's just go for it? And
yeah,
that opens up Herbert for
the Dolphins at five, then suddenly pops in. Unless Jordan Love is the number five pick. So, right. Yeah. But that's why I say I think teams are going to trade up. I think all four, you're right, I think all four go top 15, maybe even top 10 by the time it's over, just because teams, once three are gone and people think that cutoff is at four, teams are trading up to get the fourth guy.
Well, that'll be something to keep an eye on as the draft process goes on. March 12th, Herbert and all the guys will be back in town for Pro Day at Oregon, so we'll be there for that. Make sure you follow DuckSports.com for all of the regular season finale stuff from Steve on the men's basketball team, and I'll be in Vegas for the Pac-12 Women's Tournament. That should be another fun run for the Ducks. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon.